about trying these out.
Before we start the full committee work session, I wanted to take just a minute to preview for the members the upcoming agendas. We are going to attempt, with the exception of 2087, the bill that's on this afternoon, beyond the citizen bill, to finish, pretty much finish our work on all House bills by next Monday evening. In addition to the other regular work of the Committee on House Bills, we've scheduled a group of House Bills for tomorrow in Subcommittee 2 for probable tabling or interim committee, and you'll want to take a look at those in advance. I would suggest if you have a serious problem about tabling, you might let Representative Rutherford know. Otherwise, the intention is probably for pretty nearly all or all of those bills, they'll be a motion to table. Then on Monday, we have another large group of bills.
What's Friday?
Mm-hmm.
What's this Friday?
This Friday, we'll take up the DUI package.
That's right.
And complete that. Then Monday, in addition to our other work, we will have a large additional number of House bills set for interim study or tabling. Same request, and if you have a problem with any of those, please let me know ahead of time. Monday evening, we will take up a few of the remaining House bills about which either there's been a request for hearing or we will want to give a little more consideration before we finally make some decision. I include in that the work camps bill of the Corrections Division, 2671 dealing with prison industries, Representative Zajon's bill on authorizing the division to lease institutional facilities. Those are the three main ones. Then Wednesday evening, we will have a hearing on the data-based aspects of the cost, discriminatory application, and deterrence of the death penalty. That will be testimony. Testimony will be limited to those three issues and will be essentially invited testimony to deal with that data. That's next Wednesday. And I'm hopeful those two Monday-Wednesday commitments will be the pretty much the last evening time frames I'll ask the committee to make. I think from there on we hopefully will be able to finish our work on extended daytime hours.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Courtney.
I have a conflict between this committee and the Select Committee. Can I go to the Select Committee?
We're going to work to avoid that conflict, but the answer is yes, I guess.
I think we should have a
roll call. You have a conflict.
When is that conflict?
There's
that
one by the
way. When is that conflict?
I think we should take a roll call vote on where Mr. Courtney should go.
Wait a minute. You guys are supposed to meet once and vote that bill out. Now, what's this?
House Bill 2096.
I've distributed to the members the dash two amendments on this bill. This is, everything seems to be an omnibus bill. This is the omnibus business name and trademark provision bill. And I also distributed to your offices a couple days ago a memo, I guess, from me, page memo dated June 6th, which highlights the real substantive changes in the bill. Most of the bill is simply rewording of existing language to make it clearer or conforming amendments. And there might be a few other changes but ones that are not controversial that no one objected to. In any case, this memo is intended to pick up everything that does amount to a real change in the law in this area. I can either go through the memo if the committee would like or whatever the chair wants. The main, as I mentioned on Friday, the main things that this bill does are it cuts loose comparison of business names with trade and service marks so that you don't, under present law, a particular name can block registration of a trade or service mark and vice versa. All portions of the bar agree there was no reason to do that, so it cuts loose those cross-checks. There was one additional change made in these dash two amendments at the suggestion of Tom Gilbert, and I agreed and had it done in here. and that is this. The original House Bill 2096 made that change I just mentioned, cutting those business names from trade and service marks, but it forgot to make that same change for limited partnership names. And so I went ahead and had legislative counsel draft the Dash 2 amendment so that the corporation commissioner would not be required to check a limited partnership name against a trademark or service mark and vice versa. That policy is totally consistent with cutting those corporate names and missing business names. Limited partnership names are the third type of name that has to be registered with the corporation commissioner. So that is a change that's in the Dash 2 amendments as well, and that was not before the committee at the last session. The other, let's see, what are the other main points? The other main point, and this did develop some controversy, is that it pretty much opens up the assumed business name registrations. There's a fairly long line of Oregon court cases which says over and over again that registration of a business name doesn't give you any rights to use of the name. And in fact, you may register a name that you have no right to use because someone else has a superior common law right in the name. Registration is only for the protection of the public. However, Oregon statutes are worded so that the first one to register a name can effectively block somebody else from registering the name because you're not supposed to register a name that's the same or similar as a name currently on record. And so you can get a case where the first person to register did not have any right to use the name but has a kind of blackmail power over the person with superior right to use the name but who failed to register in time. This bill would essentially allow anybody to register any name, and if there is a problem about who has actual rights to use of the name, that would be settled through litigation or whatever, totally independently of the registration system. All the parties agree that the registration system has never been intended, by statute anyway, has never been intended to establish rights to use of the name. However, one section of the bar felt that it was better to keep the sort of rough and ready kind of protection that you have by being the first to register, since in most cases the first person to register does have the superior common law right to use of the name. The patent and trademarks, or let's see, I guess it's the patent and trademark section of the bar, however, said that this gives people the right to blackmail a company and force them to pay for a name that they have the right to use, since that company often can't take the time and doesn't want to spend the money to litigate their common law rights first and then go in and be able to register the name that they knew all along they had a right to use. That change is made in this bill to open up assumed business name registrations to anybody so that it would serve as a register. The public could go and find out who was the real person or entity behind an assumed business name, but otherwise it would not serve a function of trying to regulate who gets to use what name. Those are the two big changes, and the other changes, main changes, are detailed in this June 6th memo that I distributed.
Mr. Chair, I move the amendments of City Council members 2096-26783.
Mr. Courtney moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection?
Move 2096 as amended to the full floor and do pass recommendation.
Representative Courtney moves House Bill 2096 as amended be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Let's see, Mr. Hall, I guess after the initial group of amendments on page 1, the rest replaced the entire bill.
Correct.
So we don't need to really, I don't think we need any engrossment. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Baldwin?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Barron?
No.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Still have
to carry
it.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
2417. I'm handing out the Dash 1 that many of the members may already have. The original Trinidad bill provided for different procedures for a person who was wrongly served in a case. The original Trinidad bill was intended to simplify or actually allow a person who was wrongly served with a summons in a case to ignore the summons and not show up. But the subsequent discussion and hearing, the subcommittee felt that you're always going to have to show up because otherwise the default judgment will be taken against you, and then it's much harder to come in and get the default judgment eliminated by, at that point, proving that you weren't the person contained in the summons. These amendments would eliminate the printed bill and would provide that the court could allow attorney fees to a party who was wrongly served and who had to come into court to get the summons quashed. The only requirement is that the person wrongly served make written or oral demand to the party initiating the service, the demand being to drop me. I'm not the right person. You've got to drop me as a party. If the party that initiated the service fails to do so and it goes all the way to court and a court order, the court at that time can order attorney's fees to the person wrongly served. And in subcommittee, the question was asked, why is the word drop used at line 10, move to drop a party? I talked to Bob Lundy, and he said that that's Rule 30 right now. It talks about misjoinder. It says the court may drop a party, or a motion to drop a party or something. There are no longer motions to quash, so he chose the word drop.
We asked how far, Mr. Chair.
Did we adopt these amendments, Mr. Chair?
I don't believe the amendments were adopted, really.
Yeah.
Well, we adopted in the second
meeting. Yeah. House Bill 2417 is amended. Full committee, do pass recommendation.
We are in the full committee. We are there.
Good job.
Last motion, Mr. Chair. Is the House Bill 2417 as amended be reported to the floor of the do pass recommendation?
As usual, Ms. Mouse.
Further discussion?
Mr.
Chair. Mr. Carr?
Yeah, I was concerned about the 5 days that might not be long enough time to get in contact with the sheriff that you, or the private server that you've hired to serve these documents. And the plaintiff's attorney, especially if they had a statute of limitation problem, would be real concerned to find out all the facts that this was indeed the wrong person and get to the court to drop them within 5 days. I'm really concerned that that isn't enough time to go through that process.
Mr. Chairman, just want to refresh me. Isn't there, from the time that you file a suit, you toll the statute of limitations upon filing the suit, and then
you have 60 days
for the day of filing the suit to gain service of summons.
It's not really tolling, but if you file it on the last, if you file the suit on the last day, you still have 60 days beyond to serve summons, so it's as if it's tolled.
So you gain 60 days. So the second part of Representative Scavero's concern is really what happens if you're down to the 58th or 59th day and the sheriff has just found the wrong person and served them. And then that would be a concern to the plaintiff's attorney. The 5 day concern the other way, though, is. Is that a reasonable period of time within which to for a person to know that there's a problem and go see an attorney and have him advise you if there's a rule and have them contact the other side? But I think that extra 60 days is really already in the statute as a cushion from losing your suit for having served the wrong John Doe. Well, at that point, I think the onus is on you as the plaintiff's attorney, and you've had all the advantages.
Kurt?
Bob Lundy was the one who put in the 5 days initially, and in the subcommittee there was discussion that it's kind of a toothless sanction, because basically if the attorney who initiates the service drops the person as a party even an hour before the hearing motion to quash, as a practical matter, there will be no award of attorney's fees. And so really an attorney would have more than 5 days to drop the party. 5 days is simply supposed to be in there, so on first reading, an attorney would know that once he or she got a call saying, I'm the wrong person served, they really ought to get on it and not wait until just before a motion to quash, to decide whether or not it's the right person. So your concern is right, but I think as a practical matter, it isn't going to make that much of a difference, the 5 days.
Well, I think it should, just as, because you have to mail these documents to the court, the dropping, I suppose, when you move to drop is when would be when your documents reach the court. And just, I'm thinking of just the logistic time in preparing that motion and mailing it to the court. And if you're out there on the seventh day, you still owe this person attorney's fees. I think just normal course of business should, even though you were the plaintiff's attorney, I would assume hustling, and that's what I'd want them to do. I think something like 10 days would be more appropriate.
10 days.
Try a motion. Bruce Scarborough moves that in line 9, the bill be amended to substitute 10 days for 5 days. Is there an objection?
I object.
Adopted.
See,
I think it was your motion to report the bill as amended, or according to you, still press that motion?
Well, sure.
Objection to amendment?
Yeah, sure.
Further discussion of the bill as amended?
I have no objection.
Roll call.
Yes.
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
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 Ringer?
Aye.
Rutherford? Meyer?
Aye.
2629.
I'm distributing the Dash 3 amendments, which I think most of the members have.
Let me interject. Are any of these bills on the table by the rule? Let me just make a blanket motion that if any of the bills otherwise favorably acted on are on the table, they will be untabled. Is there any objection? Go ahead.
The converse of that, Mr. Chair, is that any of the acted on unfavorably that are on the table will remain tabled.
If tabled by rule, I want to untable and table them officially. I presume all these bills will be acted on favorably.
I think I'll
deal with the blessing of the committee, just that should be for the bills.
I think all the members will have in their file a hand and gross copy of the bill showing Dash 2 amendments. And these Dash 3 amendments only make two minor changes in it. Basically, the bill as a whole would allow the Department of Human Resources to get a written authorization from a public assistance applicant at any time, have it in the file, and thereafter go to a financial institution and seek to cross-check to see what kind of assets the financial institution may have in the name of the person who is on public assistance. Generally, that's anticipated to be by computer run, if possible. Let me see. The rest of the bill contains safeguards and limitations and so forth. The bank, the financial institution, is to get reimbursed for what they do. There was an amendment to Section 6, which would say that if the department finds that there are assets there in the bank of the public assistance recipient, which violates state law on how much assets you're supposed to have, the department can go in and seek appropriate relief under the provisional remedies rules right now, which will allow an ex parte freeze on an account pending litigation over whether the department has a right to recover that money or not. There was a further amendment made at the very end to make it clear that if the state goes in for provisional process, that they would not have to post a bond as other parties may generally have to do when they seek provisional process under those rules. I think these were just conceptual amendments before. But this comes with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendments as to the extent that they
are not allowed. Rutherford moves adoption of the Dash 3 amendments. Your objection? Representative Rutherford moves House Bill 2629 as amended be reported with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Excuse me, aye.
Meyer?
Aye. Mr. Chairman? Maybe Representative Rutherford told you the subcommittee had offered the bill to be carried by Representative Anderson, who was its sponsor.
Can you just remind me about that, Mr. Cullen? I was going to
suggest that Representative Otto carried the previous bill.
That was his bill.
Yeah, it was his bill.
Strong recommendation.
3632.
send out the dash three amendments on this bill. This is sort of an omnibus civil court procedures revision bill. The main thing with the printed bill, the Ann Gross version of the printed bill, does is to clarify the procedures to be followed when an action filed in the small claims department of the district or justice, let's see, I think it's just the district court, no, and justice court as well, when either a counterclaim is filed, which is over the jurisdiction of the small claims department, or when a jury trial is requested, this will clarify, specify procedures by which the parties are then to file their documents. Since at present in the small claims department, you don't file a complaint, you file a claim, and I don't even, I'm not sure you even file a written answer. When it's removed to the regular district court or circuit court, you need to get formal pleadings, and this, the bulk of the printed bill is to establish time limits and the way in which the formal pleadings are to be done and how they're to be served on the other party. These types of things are happening right now, but there's no formal procedures in the statutes. I think it's sort of done on an ad hoc basis. The other change it makes is in section one and then back in section 22, it repeals ORS 3.150 and eliminates a cross-reference, which said that in Marion County, domestic relations matters were fully referred to the circuit court. I guess Representative Gilmore had asked that be eliminated, and others had as well, since that is not the actual practice in Marion County, apparently. And so that's the purpose of that, of those amendments. Then in the minute,
was it domestic relations matters?
Or maybe?
No, it was a juvenile-related issue.
I guess I didn't bring my volume one.
What's the chapter?
It's, well, 3.150, this is special things for Marion County, and then 46, which is the district court. So, and then the amendments, dash three amendments, section 22 clarifies that the trial court retains jurisdiction after a notice of appeal is filed, retains jurisdiction for the purpose of settling the cost bill. Section 23 makes a conforming change between two different statutes regarding the amount of time that's allowed to object to a surety on an appeal bond. Section 24 is intended to clarify the present statutes regarding waiver and deferral of fees in the for indemnity in the civil action without making any changes in the law. It's supposed to clarify that they can be waived at the start of the case but reimposed at the end of the case if the prevailing party gets a lot of money in the case and is no longer indigent. And section 25 makes a similar change having to do with domestic relations cases. And I just noticed there's all sorts of other things attached to these amendments which go on different bills. I don't know, but we're all stapled together.
The chair moves the, well, let's see, with the dash three amendments adopted in subcommittee.
I move them.
Yes, they were adopted.
Yeah, they were adopted.
We're done.
Wait. Chair moves House Bill 2632 as amended be reported with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
I have a question.
Smith,
I'm trying to remember, did we deal with the transcription fee issue of the court reporters in here?
I think the subcommittee's recommendation was that nothing happened in this bill, but that it be studied either the whole issue of court reporters, transcription fees, and so forth be studied either by the interim committee or I think there might have been a preference for the commission on the judicial branch. Tracy Belshaw appeared to say that not only are the statutes covered by the amendment proposed by the court reporters ambiguous, but there's others as well, and there's interest by the bar and others about the future of court reporters, electronic recording of cases, and so forth. So her strong recommendation was that it be studied in the interim for a conference. Well, the committee wait until the present system settles down, and but it also be studied, and that some changes be made in the next session.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Gordon?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Ringer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Mike?
Aye.
approved from 645.
Handing out Hannah Gross copy showing the Dash 5 amendment. That's what I mean. This bill, as it initially came, would have created a new crime. It was to be amended. It would have been a felony to falsely claim a construction lien. This arose out of a very severe problem that someone in Representative Hewlett's district had. And the printed bill also would have allowed the award of attorney's fees by the court upon dismissal of a sham or frivolous construction lien. The bill was amended in several respects. With the Dash 5 amendments, Section 2 of the bill, instead of creating a new crime, would simply make it clear that the present crime of false swearing also encompasses a false or filing of a false construction lien, since the construction lien does have to be notarized. And so this is essentially going to be a warning in the construction lien law statutes that claiming a false construction lien would constitute false swearing under the existing law. So it doesn't create a new crime. Section 3 essentially creates a civil right of action for a person when a false construction lien is claimed. And a false construction lien is more than simply an invalid one. It has to involve some knowing elements, knowingly claiming them, or filing a lien when you know that it's unenforceable. This would, the problem under present law is that slander of title is pretty limited, and you generally can't recover from slander of title unless you show you had an actual third-party buyer who was scared off by that lien, and in many cases that just isn't the case. Section 4, the new language of subsection 2 being added to 87060, would reverse the recent trend in cases, which basically says you have to, if you're claiming on a lien, that you basically have to come in with expert witness testimony saying this was the reasonable value of this and of that. You can't, at present, you can't simply submit the invoice for what you paid. You have to have someone come in and say, yes, that was a reasonable price of what you paid. So this is to allow a prima facie case to be made out by the person who did the work, that these were my costs and they were reasonable. The bill also would clarify, present law says that attorney's fees will be allowed to the prevailing party on foreclosure of a lien, which at first glance seems to say that if the lien is disallowed, the homeowner will get attorney's fees in fighting off the lien. There's a recent Court of Appeals case, however, that says, but even though the lien is disallowed, if the builder gets some money at the end of the case on a quantum merit or other theory, a different statute defines builder as a prevailing party, so we won't give the attorney's fees to the homeowner, even though the homeowner fought off the lien in this lien foreclosure suit. The first lines of this amendment on the last page will essentially clarify a lien foreclosure is a two-stage trial anyway. First stage is determining the lien validity. Second stage is anything else. If the lien is disallowed, you can go on to another theory. This amendment would essentially have the court look at two different points in the trial to determine attorney's fees. If the lien is disallowed, the court is required to give attorney's fees to the homeowner on that issue, the issue of lien validity and lien foreclosure. And then it lets the court, then later if they go on, it allows the court to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party on the rest of the trial, if that's what the court determines. This was only conceptually amended, and now that I look at this, I'm not sure that, I think that the subcommittee asked to make the first part, the lien, allowing or disallowing the lien, a mandatory award of attorney's fees there. I just realize now they did not necessarily say the court should go on with a discretionary award of attorney's fees on the rest.
Something we can take care of now. Regarding the point where we really can't carry much over.
I have problems with Section 3, and maybe I could be talked out of them, but I just need to walk my way through it, and the committee wants to take the time now to do that. These were adopted conceptually, and I'm not sure the language that we've gotten and are just now seeing that the first time gets there.
Well, let's pass over for the time. Can you review it over the next hour or so with this stuff and
come back to that?
$28.35.
This is the ambulance lien bill. going to hand out a hand and gross version with some language from legislative council that was conceptually adopted.
I don't remember any of that.
The bill is originally a city which provided ambulance services to claim an ambulance lien similar to the hospital lien that all hospitals can claim right now, which is essentially if services are extended to an injured person, the ambulance company could send a formal notice to both the insurer and any person who might be liable to the injured person. The notice would essentially let that insurer or the tortfeasor know that they had to pay the ambulance company before pay off their charges, or else they'd be liable to the ambulance company. The committee amended it to broaden it to all ambulance companies, whether or not they're provided by a governmental entity, amended the timing and the form of notice to conform to the procedures used for existing hospital liens, and also amended it so that the notice of lien could be sent by either registered or certified.